plus papa que le pape ou le roi, le juge ou le docteur ou le législateur, qu'ils feront la loi. Allô, 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 mon corps est à moi et c'est moi qui sais si je veux ou pas.
Hi Jess.
Hi Sarah.
So we're hosting the show together today. Allison is out. And we're talking a week after France made history when it included the right to get an abortion in the constitution.
Mm-hmm. So France is the first country in the world to take such a step.
Mm-hmm.
And MPs have been pushing for this ever since the United States overturned the legal precedent that made abortion a fundamental right there.
Yeah, yeah. So the amendment guarantees the right that was legalized in France in 1975. We've talked about that before. Mm-hmm. But Parliament could have potentially repealed it if a majority of lawmakers had agreed to it.
Mm-hmm. So this is definitely historic. But,
yeah,
you know, I looked into this and it turns out this isn't the end of the story.
Mm.
Access to abortion really varies across France. So even if it's legal, actually getting one is not necessarily easy. Hospitals in general are stretched and abortion services are often one of the first things to be cut. So depending where you live, you might have to travel pretty far to find a doctor or a midwife who does it.
Yeah, yeah. And then especially if you need a surgical abortion,
mm-hmm,
like most everywhere in France, medical abortions, those are the ones done with pills, are by far the most common. It's fairly straightforward, doesn't need much medical intervention, but these are only allowed up to 7 weeks into a pregnancy. So between 8 and 14 weeks, which is the final limit in France for an abortion, you have to get a surgical procedure. And there's not that many practitioners who provide them.
Mm-hmm. Medical professionals in France can refuse to perform any kind of care for personal reasons. That's their right. And they're allowed to refuse abortion specifically, provided they refer patients to someone else instead. But in practice, a lot of people say that doesn't happen.
Yeah. So even if abortion is legal here, it can be really difficult to get one. That's the case in many places. And while France's constitutional amendment makes it a lot harder to revoke this fundamental right, it doesn't mean Parliament can't then pass laws shortening the time limit, for example.
Mm-hmm. So during the debates around the amendment, some MPs wanted stronger wording to protect effective and equal access to abortion in France, but that didn't make it into the final text. But it is still a legal milestone and a strong symbol. Campaigners in France say they hope it will inspire other countries to follow suit.
T'as voulu voir Macron et on a vu Macron. Maintenant tout est plus clair, on sait ce qu'il faut faire. Pour pas se contaminer, il faut se confiner, mais pour se déconfiner, faut être immunisé. Pour être immunisé, faut se faire contaminer. Pour se faire contaminer, faut se déconfiner. C'est QFD.
So Jess, remember where you were 4 years ago? This is March 2020.
Well, I was living in Italy, and if I remember correctly, the entire country had just gone into lockdown because of COVID-19.
Yeah, yeah, it's been 4 years.
Wow, honestly, that whole time feels like a weird dream by now.
Yeah, France shut down a week after Italy for 55 days from March 17th. Schools closed, businesses closed, like in many places, but we went above and beyond. We were not allowed outside, only for an hour at a time for specific things like shopping or going to exercise, and we couldn't go any farther than a kilometer radius from home. Mm. And all of this was self-reported, so you'd write out a certificate saying what time you left the house and for what reason, and then the police could, and they did, check that.
Yeah, it was similar in Italy. I remember getting stopped by the police in Rome and having to explain why I was going for a run.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy that we did that, but it was a crazy time with a then mysterious virus that was getting a lot of people sick,
mm-hmm,
and killing a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
France and Italy were a handful of European countries that went into full lockdown mode. So Italy, France, and then Spain and Greece. And looking back, it is really interesting that we put up with such strict rules. Nicolas Mariot thought the same thing. He's a historian. He studies obedience, things like why people respond to wartime drafts or why we pay taxes. And he teamed up with a sociologist and they surveyed 16,000 people and they ended up writing a book called L'Attestation, the attestation, that's the certificate we had to fill out, an experience of mass obedience in spring 2020. And from their research, they found that 80% of French people obeyed the rules of the confinement.
Oh, that's high.
That is pretty high. Yeah, mass obedience, as they put it. Mario says that the main reason the French followed the confinement rules wasn't so much because of their concerns about COVID, but rather the fear of getting a fine and intersecting with the police. He concluded this by looking at those who followed the confinement rules and those who followed health suggestions, you know, things like staying a meter apart or washing hands. And only 22% of people followed both of these rules. A quarter respected the confinement rules, but not the sanitary recommendations.
Pour eux, on peut pas dire que la peur du virus était très grande, hein.
We can't say that their fear of the virus was very high, and there was another group of people that surprised us a lot, those who closed themselves in completely, who chose not to go out at all, even to get some air.
Et alors nous, on pensait naïvement un peu au début.
We thought naively that they were older, medically vulnerable people.
Médicalement. Qui risquaient, gros, hein,
who were high at risk if they got COVID, but not at all. They were very young people, many women, often students, who closed themselves in and were living in the most difficult conditions, in studios or tiny apartments with no balcanies or terraces.
Et pour cela,
they chose to do this, often because they didn't really know how to adapt to the rules. In small places, in areas under high police surveillance, notably in the Paris area. That doesn't mean they agreed with the decisions made to keep them inside, but given the situation, they told themselves they had no choice. This is the way it is, and we have to follow the rules.
Mario said that their survey found that people were also policing each other, enforcing the very French ideal of equality.
Beaucoup de Français ont passé le confinement à regarder ce que faisaient leurs voisins.
Many French people spent their time in confinement looking at what their neighbors were doing and saying, they mustn't have more advantages than me. I'll respect the rules if no one else seems to be getting special treatment. That's why we observed an explosion in denunciations. People calling the police to say, my neighbors are hosting a barbecue, even though they're not allowed, or there are parents playing badminton with their kids in the street. And so this kind of negative equality played a fundamental role in people's acceptance of the lockdown.
Mario told me he experienced this personally when he'd go running in Paris. His usual parks were closed, so he was running on the city sidewalks.
Bon, c'était très, très étrange. Et il m'est arrivé plusieurs fois que...
It was very, very strange. And several times, people at their windows would complain, and let's be honest, tell me off.
Arrêtez de courir tout le temps,
saying, stop running all the time. It's not good. You should be at home.
I have to say, you know, that for me personally, the confinement rules gave me this sort of strange sense of security, you know, in the sense that I didn't feel this personal responsibility to make the decision of whether or not to go out and mix with others. You know, the rule was there. It wasn't up to me, even if I didn't agree with the rules. It kind of removed this weight of personal decision making. And I compared this, you know, with friends in many parts of the United States who were very much left on their own, right, to make decisions about what was safe or not for their families. And that seemed to be very stressful for them.
Yeah, in the UK too, it felt like everyone was basically doing whatever they felt like. Whereas in Italy, there was this sense of collective responsibility that you'd have to be like really selfish not to wear masks all the time, social distance, so on.
Right.
And I have to say, despite all the stereotypes about Italians in general, people in Italy really did embrace the rules.
Yeah, so I mean, Mario says that the French didn't necessarily embrace the rules, but they followed them. And this actually went across the political spectrum, even if there were, you know, debates and protests later, especially around the vaccines. But those confinements, especially the first one in the spring of 2020, really sparked no direct protest. And in the 4 years since, there's never been any kind of reckoning. For example, Spain's Constitutional Council last year canceled the 1.2 million fines that were handed out during their confinement. France had 21 million controls and handed out 1.1 million fines.
Qu'est-ce qu'elles sont devenues? Est-ce que les gens les ont payées? Tout ça, on ne sait pas.
What happened to those fines? Did people pay them? We don't know anything about that. And were all these fines legitimate? No one has ever discussed this. And what's surprising is that even the media, whatever their political leanings, you might have expected they'd ask questions and raise debates about this crazy experience. Well, if you look, you find nothing. There were two parliamentary inquiries, which resulted in a small paragraph about fines saying, it's too bad, it's true that a lot of fines were handed out, but we had to. And it stops there. There was no public discussion, and that's very surprising. It's something that surprises me a lot, and it's rather worrisome for the future.
So 4 years after the confinement, where does that leave us? You know, the lockdown showed the capacity of the French police state, their ability to deploy quickly, carry out all these checks. Also technologically, right? Deploying drones to monitor closed beaches and open spaces. And the confinement did shut down protests. Remember the Yellow Vests?
Right.
Yeah, the COVID confinement shut down that movement, which had been staging weekly protests against the government for about 2 years at that point. There's been research about the psychological impacts of the COVID confinement, particularly on young people who are still struggling in France today. But the impacts on our relationship to power and the police state, we'll have to see.
C'est le tango des promenades, deux parcelles sous les arcades, cerclées de corbeaux et d'alcades, qui nous protégeaient des pourquoi. C'est le tango de la pluie sur la cour, le miroir d'une flaque sans amour, qui m'a fait comprendre un beau jour, je ne serai pas Vasco de Gama, mais c'est le tango du temps béni, pour un baiser trop petit, dans la clairière d'un jeudi, à Rosie, cousine Rosa.
So Jess, I want to tell you about Rosa Bonheur, a French painter. She was born on the March 16th, 1822 in Bordeaux, 202 years ago this week.
Well, her name is certainly familiar. There's this kind of mini chain of bars in Paris named after her.
Right.
I have to admit, I wasn't always sure that she was a real person because the name sounds almost made up, right? Rosa Bonheur, it means Rosa happiness.
Yeah. But she was a real person, a very well-known artist in her time and probably the most famous female artist of the 19th century. But her painting fell out of fashion, and she's now having a bit of a revival. Born into an artist's family, Rosa was drawn to painting animals. She worked in a realist style.
She specialized in a kind of painting that is what we call animalier, which is sort of painting mostly animals.
That's journalist and writer Anna Poloni.
She was, in a way, really ahead of her time in how she thought about animals and sort of their inner lives. Like, when you look at her paintings, her portraits of animals are a lot more sort of subtle, and they express all kinds of interesting emotions in the looks that these animals have. And when you look at how she's painting humans, you can tell she's not very interested in human faces at all. She's much more interested in, you know, the lion's face and features than in the person who's standing next to the lion.
So Anna's not an art historian or a cultural journalist. She actually came across Rosa Bonheur while doing research on queer historical figures associated with Paris.
So I was looking into people like Natalie Barney, Gertrude Stein, a lot of foreigners, actually. And Rosa Bonheur's name came up as someone from a previous generation who had set a precedent by living very openly with her life partner, Natalie. And she has sort of been on the record as saying, you know, she would never marry a man, and that Natalie was the love of her life.
So Natalie is Natalie Mika, Rosa Bonheur's childhood friend with whom she lived for 40 years until Mika's death. Intrigued by this, Anna went to go see the museum that was set up in Rosa Bonheur's former home in the Fontainebleau Forest south of Paris. And she took a tour. She learned a lot about the artist. But whenever Natalie Mika came up, she was referred to as Rosa's good friend.
Yes. A lot of women have been good friends throughout history.
Sure. Yeah. And this kind of erasing of Bonheur's lesbianism or just not admitting to it, it got Anna wondering, you know, did she get it wrong? The museum guide and then the museum's owner and director spoke to her and insisted that Bonheur was not gay.
Avec Nathalie, il y a une relation qui est extrêmement forte.
That's Catherine Brao, owner of the chateau, in the documentary series that Anna ended up making with her own partner, Carole, a photographer, about Rosa Bonheur as a queer artist.
Que se passait-il dans sa tête? J'en sais rien, personne ne le sait. Mais en
what
tout
was
cas,
going through her head, asked the director. I don't know, no one knows, but I do know almost for certain that she was not homosexual in her daily life. Now, clearly the concept of homosexual and lesbian in the 19th century is very different from what we have today. But this refusal to even consider the possibility that Bonheur had a female lover, or even deciding it wasn't something to even mention, was intriguing to Anna.
She's this really incredible sort of case study in how we talk about queer histories today and some of the issues that we face today relative to like representation and things like that. The kind of double standards that are applied in France in particular around questions of private life when it comes to public figures who are from like some sexual minority. So for instance, it is perfectly acceptable to talk about so-and-so's affair if, you know, so-and-so is straight. But as soon as things have something to do with homosexuality or being a lesbian, it becomes taboo in this way where I think also the media has a tendency to put people back into the closet out of a misplaced sense of propriety. So even people who are out, publicly out, there are certain aspects of their lives that will not be discussed out of this sense of, oh, you know, we don't want to put this on the record.
Bonneau's sexuality arguably had absolutely nothing to do with her art, which, you know, was focused on animals. She wasn't painting lesbian love scenes, mm-hmm. and things like that. But Anna points out that her sexuality isn't something to ignore, especially as renewed interest in Rosa Bonheur and her work is precisely because of who she was. You know, this woman bending gender norms. You know, she wore pants or trousers at a time when that was actually illegal for a woman to do so. And she was openly living with and loving another woman.
I think there are a number of people who are coming to Rosa Bonheur because of those decisions, which de facto makes these aspects of her private life relevant to the wider public. I'm one of those people who wouldn't necessarily have gone out of my way to look at paintings of, you know, terriers. But because I know these other aspects of Rosa Bonheur's life, I became curious and I was also able to sort of appreciate what she was doing on an artistic level. And this is particularly relevant because, you know, one of the reasons why we've forgotten about Rosa Bonheur generally is because the kind of painting that she was doing fell out of fashion. And so one of the ways that you could think of, okay, you know, why would we be interested in her art today is also through other aspects of her as a person, right? And understanding that sort of more holistically too. So I think there's definitely something to be gained by, you know, including these various aspects of this artist in terms of drawing attention to her work and also her life in general.
After Nathalie Micas' death, Rosa Bonheur spent the last couple years of her life living with the American painter Anna Elizabeth Klumpke. All three women are buried together in Paris's Père Lachaise Cemetery. Inscribed on their tomb is the words, "Friendship is a divine affliction."
Mm,
a little
intriguing.
Cryptic, yeah. Mm. Rosa Bonheur received the Legion of Honor. She was the first female artist to receive it. And her paintings are on display in the Musée d'Orsay here in Paris. Her most famous painting, The Horse Fair, painted in 1855, is now at the Met Museum in New York. You can find Anna Polonyi's documentary series, The Rosa Bonheur Case, Le Cas Rosa Bonheur, on YouTube. It's in English and in French. Go check it out.
Toi qui confonds fertilité et virilité, toi qui crois que la contraception est une affaire d'ovulation, ce refrain est pour toi, pauvre con. On est déjà 7 milliards tocards, tu prends les filles pour des vaches, pauvre lâche. Deviens enfin responsable, minable. Rends-toi stérile, débile.
So, Sarah, what do you know about vasectomies?
Ah, it's a form of birth control for men, right? Mm-hmm. Like an operation that cuts the tubes in a man's testicles that carry sperm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're very widespread here in France.
No, that's right. So even if it's a relatively common form of contraception in the US, Canada, the UK, elsewhere, vasectomies actually weren't even legal in France until 2001.
Wow, that wasn't very long ago.
Yeah. So they have been increasing in the 23 years since then. Around 1,900 men had vasectomies in France in 2010. And in 2022, it was almost 30,300. That's 15 times more. But it's still a tiny fraction of men in France overall who get a vasectomy.
Huh. So why are they so rare? I mean, it seems like a pretty low-key operation, provides permanent birth control. What's not to love?
Right. Yeah. Well, it's a lot of different factors. Some are cultural, some historical, and some are to do with the way that the French health system works.
Mm.
So I spoke to someone who was preparing to get the procedure done here in France. His name's Justin. He's American, around 40, living and working in Paris. And he says for him, a vasectomy seemed like the obvious choice.
For us, three kids and three boys at this point, our lives are crazy. And we just knew that we're happy with where we are. That's, you know, we're not looking to have children again. My wife stopped birth control before we started to try to have kids. And in between, kind of never went back on. Hormone-wise, like, didn't like how it made her feel, and it wasn't something that we wanted to do again. And so this idea or thought that, like, there's the onus that's placed on the woman to have to go back on birth control as opposed to the men, you know, doing something, taking action and having a vasectomy, it was a no-brainer. There was no question in my mind that that's what I was going to do when we were done having children.
Do you know other people who've had it done? Like in the US, is that a kind of, you know, relatively normal thing to have done?
Totally common practice. So of my close friend group in high school, those who have children or are done having children, all of them have had vasectomies. The procedure for them, I believe, is fully covered by insurance, which I don't believe it's fully covered here because it's seen as an elective procedure.
And when you first approached your doctor about it, how did they respond or what did they tell you about it?
So this was funny. This was a couple of years ago. I think at that point, Ellie was pregnant with our third child. And I was very open about the fact that it was like, okay, I'm going to be looking for the vasectomy after the baby's born. And I was down getting my flu shot. So I thought I'd start with just our school nurse here. And for her, it was just kind of like, it just seemed like it was like bizarre that I was considering it. And she said, you could ask the doctor. So I just popped in and then I said, yeah, could you help me or point me in the right direction? He said, well, we don't really do that in France. And I said, what do you mean you don't do that in France? And he's like, well, you need to be ready and fertile for your second wife. And I just was like floored. Like, are you kidding me? He's like, what if you get, you know, married to someone much younger who wants to have children? Like, you need to still be able to produce sperm. And he was legitimate. Like, he was like, not joking around. It was very serious. That blew my mind.
Wow, you got to plan ahead, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of mad, right? Wow. So I ran all of this past Vincent Huppertin, who's a urologist in Paris, who's been performing vasectomies since 2011. And he told me that he hears this kind of thing a lot. He believes that some of the reservations about vasectomies in France actually come down to the fact that it was illegal for so long. And he explained that in the 1930s, when the modern procedure was first being developed, a doctor who performed it on men in Bordeaux was arrested and charged with castration, which is a crime. And the court said that even though the patients had consented to it, it was still a form of assault, essentially. And that doctor ended up serving a year in prison. And that case set the tone for decades afterwards.
Ça a fait peur aux médecins parce qu'il y a eu une jurisprudence.
That frightened doctors because there was now a legal precedent classing vasectomies as mutilation. So generations of doctors hammered home that vasectomies were a form of mutilation. Us urologists, we all came out of medical schools where our superiors told us, don't touch men. Which explains why France is so behind when it comes to vasectomies.
The law was changed in 2001 to make voluntary sterilization legal for both men and women. Huppertin says that didn't change things immediately, but he and other urologists have seen a big increase in the interest in vasectomies, especially in the past 5 or 10 years or so. And he thinks that's partly down to seeing that it is more common in other countries, as well as broader changes.
Tout en coup. La France se réveille.
All of a sudden, France is waking up and realizing that it exists, and it's practiced on a large scale. In the UK, it's available at national health clinics. In Quebec, it's a routine form of contraception for couples over the age of 40. And there's something else very important, generational change. People who are in their 40s now have grown up with this idea of equality between men and women. So these are men invested in their relationships and their children. Men are invested in equality at the heart of the family. That's why they're taking responsibility. But what surprises me is that in 2024, we're still talking about vasectomy like a revolution, when in fact, just look at the rest of the world. It's been done for ages and we know it's safe. It doesn't harm your sex life. It doesn't give you cancer. You're no less virile. Quite the contrary.
Oh, indeed. So after you've had the operation, you can still have sex just like before, but you won't be able to get someone pregnant, that's all. And you can even reverse the procedure within a certain time. But when Parliament first legalised vasectomies in France, they were pretty cautious. As well as saying you had to be over 18, acting of your own free will, properly informed and so on, the law also says you have to wait and think the whole thing over for at least 4 months in case you change your mind. And that's another thing that surprised Justin.
So I saw this doctor back in October. I legitimately had to sign a document to say that I've been, you know, told, which is fine with any procedure, you need to know the risk factors. But then I was required to take a 4-month waiting period so that I had the opportunity to be able to change my mind and I needed to really think about it. So I had to sign on the dotted line And then he had to count 4 months forward and say, I cannot give it to you until after this date.
So Justin was eventually scheduled to have his vasectomy at the end of February, and I caught up with him afterwards.
I'm doing okay.
When we spoke, it was about a week after the procedure, and he was still recovering.
Stitches on both sides, bandages here for 10 days, some soreness, a little bit uncomfortable. I haven't gone for any runs or anything and don't plan to for a little while, but otherwise it's been pretty good.
So I asked him if there'd been any surprises along the way.
They treat this like an operation. Like I'm completely scrubbed up and, you know, all the gown and everything ready to go. So then I was taken back and laid down on the operating table. Then more people started to come in. When there was like six people in the room, I remember being like, this is just a vasectomy, right? Like, this is all we're here to do. This is not, that was the last thing I remember asking.
So you said you arrived at the hospital around 3, the op was around 5, and then what time did you end up leaving?
7:30, I think. I think the operation was probably less than 20, 30 minutes. The time to come out of the anesthesia was the biggest issue, which again is not something that my friends all went through in the United States. They all just do local anesthesia and they're completely awake during the process. And that's the part that delays everything, right? Like that's the part that takes everything much longer here.
Now, I should add that Dr. Upeton says that he and a lot of other doctors don't put patients under general anesthesia for a vasectomy. He uses local anesthetic, maybe a sedative if someone's really anxious. And that's partly because he uses a less invasive technique with a needle instead of a scalpel. But he says the way that France's healthcare system works, the more difficult or risky a procedure is, the more of the cost is covered by national health insurance. And because a vasectomy under local anesthetic is such a straightforward procedure, Upeton says that national health insurance only pays for a very small part of it, which actually makes it more expensive for patients unless they have very comprehensive private insurance. So Dr. Upeton is actually trying to change this. He and other members of the French Urology Association are pushing for vasectomies to be better covered by national health insurance, and to be able to get one in a doctor's office without having to go into an operating theatre. They also want to get rid of the four-month waiting period. And he says they've had a positive response, but change is slow. Meanwhile, the process isn't quite over for Justin either.
Now it's a three-month waiting period to see if it was effective. They do samples, sperm samples, to see if sperm is still coming through. Fingers crossed. I don't want to do it again.
Yeah, I bet.
And then at that point, I should be hopefully good. Unless, of course, I need to impregnate a younger wife in the future. Then I would have to return to have it reversed.
Sauter du train en marche, ça fait cow-boy, c'est sûr. Mais si tu te ramasses dans 9 mois, coup dur. C'est toi qui jouera au petit train avec une poussette, un bambin au fond du jardin en poussant des cris d'indien.
That's it for the show. This episode was mixed by Cécile Pompiani.
Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International. If you like the show, please consider rating or even reviewing us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen.
You can write to us. We're at spotlight.france@rfi.fr. We'd love to hear from you. What would you like us to cover? Do you have any questions about France? Send them along to us.
Find us also on Instagram at spotlightonfrance. We'll be back in 2 weeks on Thursday, March 28th. Bye, Jess.
Bye, Sarah.
Prends les filles pour des vaches, Poblache. Deviens enfin responsable, minable. Rends-toi stérile, débile.
Bah, en plus, c'est mal remboursé.